because I think of myself, I would be so upset if everyone else around me in the healthcare system knew that I was entering into what was probably the last year of my life and no one told me, that they just continued to be cheerleading around me. Oh, you must be positive, stiff upper lip, you know, don't say those things and sugarcoat everything, because at some point the gig is up. I'm going to be bedridden and say to them, did you know this was going to happen? Because quite frankly, I would have spent this last year or months differently had I known. I have a right to know when I've entered into the last year or two of my life, and it is possible to predict that for people.
This is Coming of Age, Meeting the Needs of Our Aging Population, a podcast about how we can better support our seniors. I'm your host, Donna Duncan. I am also the CEO of the Ontario Long-Term Care Association, which represents about 70% of long-term care homes in Ontario, Canada. This episode was generously sponsored by our sector champion, Point Click Care. Point Click Care is a leading healthcare technology platform enabling meaningful collaboration and access to real-time insights at any stage of a patient's healthcare journey. Point Click Care's single platform spans the care continuum, fostering proactive, holistic decision-making and improved outcomes for all. Over 25,000 long-term post-acute care providers and more than 1,600 hospitals use Point Click Care today. For more information on Point Click Care's software solutions, visit pointclickcare.com. Welcome to a new episode of Coming of Age. Today, we have an inspiring guest joining us to discuss a topic that unfortunately touches us all. Changing our perspective and understanding of our journey with life-changing illness and what we mean when we talk about palliative care and a palliative philosophy. It's a privilege to speak today with Dr. Samantha, or Sammy, Winemaker, a palliative care physician and co-author of Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest, co-written with Dr. Xian Xiao. This book offers a comprehensive guide for patients and caregivers facing life-changing illness and encourages a palliative approach to care earlier in the progression of their disease. It includes practical tools, real-life stories, and valuable insights drawn from their many years of listening to patients and through their research. It's a great resource for everyone, including for those living in long-term care. Dr. Winemaker is a family physician and associate clinical professor in the Division of Palliative Care at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. In this episode, we explore how Sammy, as she likes to be called, has started a movement to transform how we perceive palliative care. It is more than end-of-life care, but rather a philosophy of care that can prepare individuals and their loved ones for a better experience as they move through the progression of their illness. Let's dive in. I want to start off, for the benefit of our listeners, your book, Hope for the Best, Plan for the Rest. As a palliative care physician, someone who goes into people's homes, you've got a depth of experience. I know that you're an educator and a leader in this space. What was the impetus for this book? And would love to understand what motivated you to write it and for whom did you write it?
First of all, Donna, thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I'm so excited. Anytime I get to speak about palliative care, it's therapeutic for me. And thank you for asking about our book. What can I tell you? If you really just want me not to sugarcoat things and tell you the real deal, I will share with you that it probably came from a lot of frustration. That's where it was born out of. Having cared for thousands of people in their homes and listening to their illness journeys, it became very clear that their stories were shining light on a very problematic illness experience that started almost right from the time of diagnosis. And so where I have spent most of my career talking and teaching and researching around end-of-life care, I realized that the only way that we are ever going to change end-of-life care and the dying and improve that is if actually we start looking at what are the problems upstream from the very start of a diagnosis, where patients and families embark on a journey that they're really not prepared for and they don't even know what they don't know. And there's a cumulative set of problems that happen on the conveyor belt of healthcare that culminate and amplify suffering at the end of life. And so we can focus on end of life. We must change the beginning. And so we decided to pivot from only teaching healthcare providers how to provide palliative care to really looking at what can we offer citizens of the world, the public, so that when they get a progressive life-limiting illness, they have a fighting chance with a guidebook on how to be a patient or caregiver. And who did I write it for? We wrote it for the patient, but the covert operation is that it's also for family and caregivers, and it's also for care providers, but it is written in the language directly to the patient.
It really is a wonderfully accessible book, I have to say. I didn't know what to anticipate when I opened the pages. And it really does provide almost a journey map with some very thoughtful framing and 7 steps to guide individuals through their journey. And whether you're a provider, whether you're a patient, whether you're a family, chosen family or friend. And I do wonder, to your point, how much of this doesn't even have to wait for a diagnosis, as we're certainly hearing more and more individuals want to age in place. We know that there's stigma against aging. Speaking with someone the other day whose family member has, quote, moved into palliative care. In this conversation I was having with a family member, it was like, oh no. We deal with stigma every day with aging, stigma with the notion of moving into long-term care. But also there's this connotation of palliative care as well. And I'd love your reflection on that, because I do wonder how we can change our philosophy earlier on and see this as less of a fearful period.
You're absolutely right. We often refer to the word palliative as the P word. It is heavily laden with meaning for people. And it usually is synonymous with end of life care. Your time is up. It is often used as a label, your palliative at in a person's life. And so who wants that? No one really. So it is a problem the way the word has been used and how people see the word. So we're really trying to change the way the public thinks about the word palliative. We want people to think of it more as a philosophy of care, an approach to care that all healthcare providers can participate in. It's not that you have to be transferred to some Grim Reaper palliative care team, that it really, when you break it down, is really just about very patient and family-centered care. It is just good healthcare. But we have over-specialized it, and we've used the word in so many different ways that the word itself becomes a barrier to accessing the kind of care people need. And to your point about, even if we look beyond people who are facing progressive life-limiting diagnoses, and we just think about aging, there's probably lots of parallels, because this book and the idea of infusing a palliative philosophy early on is meant for people who are entering a stage of life where they feel loss of control. They may feel loss of personhood. They may be grieving many different losses. And so when you think about aging, those themes can be quite prevalent for the average aging person as well. So a palliative approach doesn't have to be reserved for only someone with a grave diagnosis. The type of care and philosophy of palliative care would benefit, quite frankly, anyone that is going through some kind of health issue, but also just good old aging, to make sure that they have meaning and feel that their life is worthwhile as they age.
What's the difference between palliative care and hospice? We certainly here in Ontario, Canada, we talk about whether someone's going to move to hospice. We have home care, home and community care, long-term care, primary care, hospital care. And then we put this label on palliative care, but then there's this other box called hospice. Is there a difference?
Yeah, again, contributes to the overall confusion. But in Canada, the way we use the words is, okay, hospice is a care setting. It's usually a bricks and mortar building that has anywhere between 6 and maybe 10 rooms where people go at the end of life. So it is a care setting for end of life. And many hospices have programs that run out of them, like bereavement programs or volunteer programs or social programs, but it is a care setting with programming. In that care setting, people receive palliative care and a palliative approach. But palliative care and a palliative approach is across all care settings. So it's almost like an umbrella term compared to a hospice, which is end-of-life care, including their programming. So I don't know if that's helpful. But palliative care can be offered in acute care, in retirement homes, in the home setting, in hospices. So hospices are a building for end-of-life care.
And that's really helpful. Our ministry in the government of Ontario introduced new legislation that actually mandates a palliative philosophy in long-term care. And there is some tension around that among stakeholders, families, residents, other providers, because there's this fear then, if I go to long-term care, this is end-of-life care. I think that the legislation and the work that's being done from a policy framework really is about how do we support quality of life and living in long-term care within the context of that palliative philosophy. So we're trying to reconcile those and welcome any thoughts on how do you reconcile living with a palliative approach?
Yeah, so even in long-term care, we're trying to get over that hurdle of what does the word palliative mean to people. And so I think we have to think about when policies say we need to improve a palliative approach in a care setting, it doesn't mean we have to start calling everyone palliative and using the word with patients and families necessarily. When people come to long-term care, my understanding is that they usually have a length of stay for about 18 to 24 months. So essentially, they are usually in the last year or two of life. And many are coming with what they would think are chronic illnesses that really are not just chronic. We know that many illnesses right from the get-go are progressive, meaning they change over time. They move from one chapter to the next, and decline is expected. And so I believe that people in long-term care probably feel that if we start talking about palliative care and long-term care, that it means that we won't get active care, that we won't get care that allows us to live our best life for the last year or 2 years. But that's not what it means. It means being hopeful and being the best you, but at the same time recognizing the truth and reality of the reasons why you've come into long-term care and what our realistic expectations are for how things are going to unfold while you're here. But you don't give up anything. I mean, you might grieve leaving your home and coming to long-term care. There are losses, but the expectation is not that when you come to long-term care that you're giving up things.
You've made an important point, and it is something that you speak to in the book, and that's the need to be educated about a diagnosis. For our listeners, again, I really encourage you to read this book. There are tips and exercises, but there are also real life stories. And oftentimes, individuals and families don't ask the questions to understand what is the course, the path, what should their expectations be of a diagnosis, for instance, of a chronic disease or a progressive disease or a life-altering disease, and understanding what does that actually look like. My takeaway from your book is that where we'd ask the questions, our path and our journey might be very different.
Oh, hugely different, because if we can set realistic expectations, then people won't feel like they're jumping from one crisis to the next crisis. We know that, for example, when someone is in the advanced stage of dementia, that they will lose the ability to swallow and not be able to eat or drink. This is a normal part of advanced dementia. But of course, if you're a family and you don't know that and you don't expect that, then that becomes a crisis. And then families start asking for things like feeding tubes. Or if you don't know when someone has Parkinson's, that it gets to the advanced stage and the person is going to become bedridden because mobility is so affected, then when your loved one becomes bedridden, again, it becomes a crisis, and transfers to ER and hospital are more likely because we just didn't share what was actually a normal part of this illness. And so it's a real missing piece, a gap from the tools that we can offer each other as healthcare providers and families and patients to know and to plan and to be ahead of the curve, that these are normal hurdles that people have to face in any particular illness. Every illness is different. So the ALS journey looks different than the MS journey, multiple sclerosis, than the dementia journey or the Parkinson's or this chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or cirrhosis, liver disease, chronic kidney disease. All of them have an overarching storyline that isn't the individual's exact storyline, but it does give people a roadmap of what to expect in chapter one, middle of the road, advanced chapters, and the terminal chapter.
You use an example in the book that really struck me, where you speak to the experience of an individual and a family where the patient had a life altering disease, had seen a transplant as the only solution, and in the absence of, and had expectations about what their end would look like, and so opted for what we in Canada called MAID, or medical assistance in dying, rather than go live through the stages of the illness. And I'm wondering if you could speak about medical assistance in dying. We know that there will be a percentage of the population that will need more complex care, who will face life-altering diagnoses, have chronic progressive illness that they could be planning for. Individuals are saying, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to apply for medical assistance in dying. And this is my choice. And this is what we're going to do. I know that you are not a MAID practitioner, but you are a MAID assessor. And I know in your palliative care experience with patients and their families that this is something that you're navigating and supporting individuals through.
Yes, I'm happy to speak to the topic of MAID. It became legal in 2016 in Canada. And right from the beginning, I stepped forward as an early MAID assessor. And the reason for doing that is because I was looking through a harm reduction lens when I decided to be an assessor. And what I mean by that is that in my entire career before MAID became legalized, I had lots of people ask me to end their life. And so what I needed to do is really just offer myself. And I had to unpack for years, one by one, where their suffering was coming from. I had to listen. I had to try to understand their suffering. And sure enough, many people had misconceptions about what natural dying was going to look like, because they were worried that they would have terrible pain. That pain was horrible part of dying, or that they would suffocate, or that they would choke. They had all these ideas about dying. And when I course corrected what natural dying looked like, 9 out of 10 times, the request for death melted away. So when MAID became legal, I realized that people who are looking at the option of MAID are probably the same kind of people I've always met. They're people with half-truths and misinformation about what to expect, and they anticipate the worst. And Hollywood, they do us a disservice when they picture dying and death as a horrible experience. So the harm reduction piece comes where if someone's asking for MAID, we go over what is MAID, what are the benefits, and what are the risks and burdens of MAID. But in order for someone to make an informed decision, we have to also describe the alternative. And the alternative to MAID is dying naturally. And so we must make sure that people that are requesting MAID also understand what their natural dying would look like, what to expect, what happens, what doesn't happen, what supports are available to them, the role of hospice, the role of home care. Only then can they actually weigh both options. So many people ask for MAID because they're scared of pain. And I think that's probably similar to long-term care. So many people might say, I'd rather have MAID than go into long-term care, because they really don't know what to expect in long-term care. And they are influenced by the horror stories they hear. So they're probably, again, making a choice where they don't know what it would be like to naturally unfold in long-term care. And the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know. If this MAID thing is something that's available, like, sign me up for that. So people need information, and they need information not at the point of making a decision only, but they need to have better health literacy and better information along the entire journey, so that this is not a conversation that's happening in a crisis.
I do think that there's a real fear of death, fear of pain, fear of the unknown. I've had the great privilege of being a frontline volunteer in palliative care and have sat with strangers who've passed away, but also with my mother, with my father, with other family members when they passed away. I've seen people die where it's been a beautiful spiritual experience, and I've seen people die poorly. And I think fear and resistance has really been at the core of those ends of life that have been less prepared for, if I could say that. You talk about the fear, you've talked a lot about grief, and yet you've also spoken about the living. And in your book, you touch on some of the emotional journeys that people are on, and there is joy. As you age, there are lots of opportunities for joy. How do you reconcile grief with hope?
You know, both hope and grief are constructs that are very protective through an illness journey and through life. But both of them only work to our advantage if simultaneously they are matched to the reality of what's happening. Where we run into trouble is when someone is hoping for something that's unrealistic. It almost becomes a wish more than a hope. So for example, if someone still thinks they're in the early part of an illness and they're hoping for a cure, when really they're at a later stage of their illness and there is no chance for a cure, then hope becomes mismatched to the reality. And so they've lost the opportunity to allow their hope to transform. Hope is incredible. It can move alongside an illness journey and stay very high as long as the person has realistic information so that their hope can transform. So for example, someone might hope for a cure at the beginning, but then when they learn that's not possible, they might hope for another treatment. And then if that doesn't work, they might hope for another treatment, and then hope for as much time as possible, then hope for comfort, then hope that their family does well, hope that they're not a burden, hope that they die comfortably. So the hope remains high, but it must be realistic, which means they need realistic information. And same with grief. Grief helps us to prepare for an eventual loss. It's called anticipatory grief. And it allows us to begin to let our mind wander over the losses we're going to have through an illness journey. But it can't blossom if we put our heads in the sand and pretend there's not going to be a loss, or we're always going to have another treatment in the cupboard, or we live in a good dose of denial. Then a death becomes more like a sudden death experience than an expected death. So the beauty of an expected death, where we know we have an illness that is progressive and is going to change and worsen and up in death at some point, is that time is on our side, which is very different than a sudden death in a car accident or a lightning, where there is no time. Time is our currency in this field. There are things that people can do to exploit their time if they can remain hopeful and allow anticipatory grief to evolve and be realistic about what's happening. They'll have more agency and feel more control over the time they have left and really be able to tailor the last chapter of their life to match who they are as a person. Because I think of myself, I would be so upset if everyone else around me in the healthcare system knew that I was entering into what was probably the last year of my life and no one told me, that they just continued to be cheerleading around me. Oh, you must be positive, stiff upper lip, you know, don't say those things and sugarcoat everything. Because at some point the gig is up. I'm going to be bedridden and say to them, did you know this was going to happen? Because quite frankly, I would have spent this last year or months differently had I known. I have a right to know when I've entered into the last year or two of my life. And it is possible to predict that for people.
You've made such a point around that fight and to keep, you know, fighting the good fight.
Cheerleading.
You read so many. I certainly read obituaries. I'm fascinated by people's lives lived. And so many say that the individual lost their fight with whichever disease, and it frames death as failure.
Yeah, and failure that the person didn't pray hard enough or will themselves hard enough, or it's blaming and shaming, actually. And it's unfair, really, because it becomes a form of silencing, actually, for patients. And they've told us that when people around them are just saying, fight, 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 battle, battle, battle metaphor, and inside they're feeling like, I wish someone would just talk to me about the truth of this. I want to share my feelings. I don't want to have to fight. I want to love and hug, and I want to talk about the things I want to leave behind for my family. There's life stuff that I want to review and reconcile. I've got projects I want to do, but everyone around me is telling me that I have to be this fighter, but I'm tired and I want to shift focus. And so again, it really causes a form of silencing.
I think that's so insightful. Again, it speaks to communication, questioning the act of listening and sharing information. In that context, then, to your point, what is the role of families, chosen families, friends? We had a discussion with an aging expert who said none of us is actually truly independent. We're all dependent. And living and aging are actually team sports. What recommendations and advice and thoughts do you have for family members and, again, those chosen family, friends, neighbors who are supporting someone who is on this journey?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, we have to acknowledge that this is an illness experience for them as well. They will experience their loved ones unfolding but they too are going through a grieving process, change of life, having to alter their responsibilities, what's on their plate. And if we don't talk about the role of family early on, as things are maybe beginning to change, then they find themselves in situations and in roles that they weren't prepared for. And we end up having almost like a two for one, two people unfolding instead of one person. So families deserve the exact same information and maybe sometimes even more about what the caregiver role is going to be than the patient. So my recommendation is that families find their voice, that they attend appointments, not just when things are not going well, but always if they can, that they come from the back seat of the car to the front, and that they bring themselves forward and not be passive and polite. I mean, we can be polite, but try to feel invited to be respectfully assertive and activated as a family. When I go into people's houses, I'm assessing multiple layers. I'm assessing the patient. Who's their natural family that's surrounding them? How willing and competent and interested and fact-finding and involved is the family, the nursing layer, the primary care practice? There are all these layers wrapped around a patient. And depending on those individual layers, things might go well or not go well. And the family layer is critical. So certain ingredients fare better than others. So a family member or two that is more organized, who ask lots of questions, who are assertive, who seek information, I say to myself, okay, this is going to go okay because we have that kind of family. But other families think that the healthcare system is going to organize everything, you know, give them information when they need to know it. They run the risk of just going from what feels like a very reactive crisis to crisis illness pattern. So families are hugely important. They are our care team in every single care setting.
It really is so thoughtful. And I know from my own personal experience with my family supporting my mother through her journey, I would say remarkably, my mother was the one with foresight, who was the planner, who wanted to educate, who wanted to plan, prepare, have those very candid discussions with me and my siblings, but also our extended and chosen family around what her expectations. I think about aging and my father, when he first got a diagnosis of dementia, is our journey in supporting him at home, first at home, and then in long-term care was about 15 years. We started our planning with that initial diagnosis and really wanted to learn. What I would say where we were challenged at front, though, to your point, was the medical practitioners weren't always educating us. We were going with questions. We were the ones who were challenging. And this was a number of years ago. And I do believe we've come so much further. But how do we build, as we think about this aging demographic, the health systems, not only in Canada, but around the world, we're trying to keep people from hospital, really do want to encourage people to support them aging in place, living at home as long as possible. We want to ensure that long-term care is going to be there for those, the small minority who are actually going to need more specialized care as they may get older or have progressive diseases. What can we do better? And I'm asking you now as an educator to build other capacity in this system to support these discussions, to support this education, and to bring in those family members and others earlier. Is this something primary care providers are educated, specialists? Where is that duty of care?
Yeah, Donna, it's pretty concerning that in, you know, the education of healthcare providers, and I can mostly speak for medical education for physicians, that we still do not have mandatory training in things like caring for people at home or palliative care. So it is not mandatory. When I went through training, I had to learn how to deliver babies. I had to learn how to reduce a fracture, even though I was never going to do that. But every doctor is going to have to interface with someone with an advanced illness who is going to enter a normal chapter of life called dying. And so why we don't train accordingly is somewhat of a mystery, but not completely. Doctors and nurses and healthcare providers are first and foremost humans. And as species, we do have a high dose of fear of death and death denial. And so doctors like to fix things. They go to medical school to try to, in quotations, help and cure and fix. And that's the culture of medical training. We are overtrained in hospitals and clinics, and most don't ever step foot in caring in the home. So how are doctors supposed to appreciate the broad role of a family as integrated as part of our care team if they don't ever have the experience of seeing what they shoulder in the home and how unbelievably integral and valuable they are to our team? And so this is one of the reasons why I think they are not well integrated into the conversations about healthcare reform, into the curriculum. So if we don't train doctors, then how can we expect them to get this? And so again, teaching already graduated folks how to do this, it's much more difficult. It's almost after the fact when people have already established practice patterns. Only 10% of doctors who graduate ever go on a home visit. And so are we surprised? No, because we don't teach it. I have someone right now, a resident, who is in the last week of his residency for family medicine. And this is the first rotation where he has done home-based care. He has said, I absolutely love this rotation in palliative care. This is really the kind of care I thought I was going to be doing as a doctor. This is why I went into medicine. But you see, that stuff gets washed out of the environment of medical training as the drivers become keeping people out of the ER, charging people from hospital faster and more furiously, efficiencies and fiscal responsibilities. People forget that the reason why they went into healthcare is to provide very human-centered care, which is palliative care. It is the antidote to feeling helpless as a healthcare provider. Healthcare providers get way too focused on the day-to-day, the weeds, the trees, the minutiae, the microscopic parts of an illness, because those are the things that they feel they can fix. But they're scared of looking at the big picture and the long view of an illness journey because, quite frankly, we can't change. There's no cure for many of these illnesses. And so just calling it for what it is feels like a failure to many doctors.
To your earlier point, that palliative journey could be a 20-year journey. It's not necessarily a three-month journey as we think about someone who might transition into hospice or someone moving into long-term care. So the average age of admission into our long-term care homes in Ontario from hospitals is 81 years old. And so if we think about the anticipated lifespan just based on age, we should be less fearful. And I do follow you on social media, and you do have a pinned tweet that's up today around palliative care is not owned by one specialty in healthcare and should be naturally infused into the entire care journey, delivered seamlessly without labels, and an approach to care that balances hope and reality. And that's so compelling, whether that's a chronic disease, a progressive illness, if it's someone transitioning an end of life just by virtue of your age. If you're in your 80s, you may have another 20 plus years left. But what are you planning for and what are those discussions? And we know that in long-term care, the majority of individuals admitted into long-term care have multiple diagnoses. So the COPD, they may have a congestive heart failure, most will have some form of dementia. So it's really for families to communicate and have those discussions around what are those expectations. So how do those things come together? And how do we support, again, that living journey, but also make the end less fearful? And there is so much joy to be had in that. I want to ask you our final question, the waiting room revolution, working to build a social movement around this. I would love for you to share, what is the waiting room revolution?
I just have to tell you that if you had asked me 20 years ago or told me, guess what, you're going to try to start a social movement, I would have laughed. Like, this is something that wasn't planned. It just needed to be. So Sienna and I, again, have decided to start a social movement called the Waiting Room Revolution. And the reason why we called it that is because when people are in waiting rooms, they are feeling lost, scared, anxious for what they're waiting for. It is a very vulnerable place to be sitting. The power differential between the doctor and the patient in the waiting room is quite large. And so people are just sitting there not knowing. And also metaphorically, people are in a waiting room when they are moving through a health journey or aging, when they don't know where are things at, what to expect. They don't know what they don't know. So it is a metaphor really for feeling like you're in the twilight zone, in a vortex where you can neither plan or see the future. Psychology very clearly tells us that when people get information, for better or worse, they actually do better than no information. There is nothing worse than waiting for test results. Even when people get test results that they're not happy with, they can be sad, they can wish it never happened, but it gives them an opportunity to adjust and move on. So the waiting room is about making sure that patients and families and citizens have all the information they need so that they don't feel they're just bobbing around. When people become a patient, that's a role that doesn't come with a handbook. And I think there's more out there for caregivers, but still, most people don't identify themselves as a caregiver early on in an illness journey. So our Waiting Room Revolution is about social messaging. We have a website, www.waitingroomrevolution.com. On the website, we have our 7 keys or secrets or mindsets that we share with people that can help improve their illness journey, even though we can't change the underlying illness. We have our podcast available on our website. We have now the book that's available on our website. We're hoping to have a course that's going to be part of this social movement. And we're trying to get out and speak as much as we can. And this is why I'm so grateful to be invited onto this podcast, because long-term care is a care setting that is deserving of a palliative approach and would probably make the environment actually feel more less scary for people because they are in the know instead of in the dark. And it makes healthcare providers feel like there's always something they can do, even if it's just listen. So it's super powerful. And I just think that we're trying to course correct where we have really gone off the rails in our focus in healthcare, really, and bring it back to the person, give back the power to the patient and the family to be involved and more than involved in their own individual illness journey.
It's so well said. We in Ontario, Canada, currently have 40,000 people waiting for long-term care. We know that with the baby boomer demographic coming, the discussions need to change and we need more transparency. We need to better manage expectations. We need to, as individuals and as family members, have those discussions and prepare ourselves and ready ourselves for what our options are or aren't. And we are just so grateful to you and to Dr. Xiao for leading this revolution. And we look forward to engaging our listeners in this revolution. I believe it is time. The time for your revolution has come. And I want to thank you for your leadership, your compassion, your empathy, and just look forward to continue to work with you and support your efforts and to build the movement. So thank you so much.
Donna, welcome to the revolution. You're now an honorary member. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to Coming of Age, the podcast that is changing the conversation on seniors' care and aging. We hope this episode brings a new perspective and inspires you to continue the conversation with your colleagues, friends, and family. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so that more listeners will join our community of changemakers in seniors care. Until next time, I'm your host, Donna Duncan. Keep well.